Hello, my name is Maggie Mastin, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Sahir Salad, current director of research for the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, and author. Today, Dr. Salad is visiting Dickinson College to deliver a lecture titled Muslims and the Global War on Terror, How the Racialization of Muslims Justifies the Expansion of Policing and Surveillance. Welcome, Dr. Salad.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's great to have you. I was hoping we could talk about your first book to start off, Forever Suspect, Racialized Surveillance of Muslim Americans in the War on Terror. It's based on 48 in-depth interviews of South Asian and Arab Muslim Americans. I was hoping you could tell us about this interview process and how you formatted what you were asking and, yeah, what was the process of interviewing like?
Yeah, thank you. And also thank you for having me. I'm having a great time at Dickinson. Everybody's been wonderful. Those are interviews that I did for my dissertation. Mm-hmm. And I was in grad school. I went to Loyola University in Chicago. And I knew I wanted to do something on the experiences of racism that Muslims were having because it was after 9/11. So I started grad school a few years after 9/11 had happened. And that experience had changed so much for me that I knew that it had, you know, I wanted to understand this in more depth. So I actually, when I was in grad school working with my professors, I decided I would do these interviews to ask them about what their experiences were like before and after 9/11. And because I was studying race and racism, the language in the scholarship that I was reading didn't have anything really that could apply directly to Muslims. So, you know, a lot of the race scholarship I was reading was on African-American experiences or, you know, maybe some experiences with, you know, immigrant groups, but nothing about Muslims specifically. So anyway, I decided that I was going to interview South Asian and Arab Muslim Americans, people who were citizens. And I had developed, you know, through my methodology, like you have to take qualitative and quantitative methods as a PhD student. So you learn how to do it. But I created this list of questions that were like, what were your experiences like before 9/11? What were your experiences like after 9/11? And I didn't ask them specifically about racism because I didn't want to lead them. You know,
that
to
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and you learn this if you take a methodology class. You're not, you know, you have to be very careful about mm-hmm. leading them into saying something. They, you know, respondents are often curious what you want them to say, and you want them to say what, you know, what their experiences were. So, you know, initially it was like, you know, the questions were very like general, like, what were your experiences like with your neighbors? What were your experiences like? Who were your family and friends? Like, you know, your friends. And then after 9/11 happened, you know, did anything change? What were your, you know, experiences or relationships like with your neighbor? So I just had this set of questions, and it was loose in the sense that it was semi-structured in that if they said something, I'd follow up with another question. I wasn't stuck to the questions that I had. And so after I did about four interviews, what came up was my respondents started saying, I would end it. And I said, is there anything that I didn't ask that you want to talk about? And they were like, well, you didn't ask about my airport experiences. I hadn't put that on the interview questions because it was in 2009 that I had, you know, did these interviews, and the term flying while Muslim wasn't really a coined term yet. And, you know, so I started to ask those questions after people kept saying that to me, and I was like, oh. And so then I got all these, they were like, well, in airports, I'm experiencing like this and that. And so that was interesting that I didn't have it on there. And then it wasn't until, you know, I did a few that I was like, I need to start asking them about airports.
Whole interviewing process is so delicate.
Yeah.
It's really nice that you were able to like adjust to the responses that you were getting throughout.
Yeah, you kind of have to because you learn. You think you know things, you know, you've read everything. Maybe I'm from a Muslim family. I was like, I know. And then you realize you don't, you know, that you have to really listen.
Yeah. Were there any particularly difficult parts of the interview process?
Yeah, so at that time, when I was initially interviewing people, and this is 2009, and a lot of my participants, because they're South Asian and Arab, you know, in their mind, race, and, you know, I didn't ask them, have you experienced racism? But in their mind, because I was asking them, oh, you know, did anyone ever say, you know, when somebody would say, somebody yelled at me, oh, what did they say or whatever? In their mind, racism was really, wasn't about them, because they saw racism as being really a black and white issue in the United States. So when I would first say, the first question I would ask is, after I asked them pre-9/11, I was like, so after 9/11, did anything change? And a lot of people would say, no, 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 no. Everything's fine. There, I've had no problems in the United States, like nothing. So a lot of the actually women, because I note that there's a gendered difference in their experiences with racialization in the book, the women would say that. And so, you know, these are women, some of them who wear the hijab, and I was like, okay, yeah, great. I'm glad to hear nothing has changed. And then it wasn't until we started talking that something would come up like, well, you know, this man yelled at me on the street. This woman approached me and told me to get out of here. Or somebody said, you can take that off. You're living in the United States now. So like, it was just interesting to me that like at that time period, people were very resistant to openly and instantly acknowledging that they had had these experiences because they were Muslim. Whereas now when I've interviewed people since, it's a totally different. Yeah. Like people are like, yes, the word Islamophobia, the experiences are more, I feel like people are more open to talking about them.
They're like experiences were disconnected from how like we might define them today.
Right. So exactly. Yeah.
I would also, you mentioned that you write in this book about gendered forms of racism and racialization.
Yeah.
So wondering for our audience, could you explain what you mean by that? And is this type of racialization, this distinction, specific to Muslims, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I was, one of the things when you're studying race and racism or anything in sociology is that everything's compartmentalized. So, you know, people will talk about race or racism and how it's enacted as if it's uniform. And when I was doing these interviews, what I was noticing is that men and women had different experiences with it. So women who wear the hijab, for example, were visibly marked as Muslim because they wear a religious symbol. Whereas Muslim men, there was really nothing identifying them as Muslim, but it was their Muslim name in airports, for example, that marked them as Muslim, you know, or if they told somebody that they were Muslim. So what I found through interviewing people is that racialization as a process is not uniform, that it's actually deeply gendered. And men were experiencing one form of racialization, like where the state or the government was marking them as a potential threat, whereas Muslim women who wore the hijab were treated in public spaces or in airports as if they were more of a cultural threat, a threat to ideals of what's feminism and democracy and things like that. So they had very different experiences around, you know, this process of racialization. So I would say, yes, it applies to all groups, that we can never say that race or racism, like everybody's experiencing it uniformly. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have the same experience sometimes as, you know, as a man or as, you know, or as anybody on the gender, you know, spectrum or whatever, but that, you know, it operates and it is, we just can't treat them all as if they're exactly the same, that gender, sexual orientation, all these things play a role in understanding how people experience racism.
You were talking earlier too about how a lot of Muslims didn't necessarily think that like racism, the concept of racism applied to them as much as we've seen it in the United States history as with African Americans and white people. And in your most recent book, A Global Racial Enemy, you have sections in your acknowledgments titled Rethinking Islamophobia and the Racialization of Muslims. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping you could talk about your application of racism and why we're choosing to talk about it in the context of Muslims and a bit of the debate around that term and using Islamophobia instead.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I want to note is that for Muslims, it's important to note, and I have an article out on this, that there are African-American Muslims. So mm-hmm. the in the first book, it was South Asian and Arab Muslims. So they, you know, so not all Muslims, right? Like their ethnicities intersect with their religious identity and how they're racialized. So African-American Muslims had very different responses that when I interviewed them about their experiences with racism. They would say, absolutely. But they differed in that they did not think they were experiencing some of the anti-Muslim sentiments that they assumed were tied to being marked as Arab or from another country. So it's interesting because Muslims are very diverse. In terms of Islamophobia, and this is an interesting one because in my work as the director of research, we use the term Islamophobia. So there's an Islamophobia index. We have Combating Islamophobia. And as an academic, prior to joining ISPU, I make this argument, and it's very short, and it's something I want to think about more and expand on, but that racialization for me felt like a better, a more accurate way to describe what Muslims were going through than Islamophobia for a couple of reasons. For me, the term Islamophobia in and of itself is problematic. It's, you know, phobia. You know, when we look at the term phobia, there are a couple things happening here. First, it's defined as an irrational fear. And I don't think that what's happening with Muslims and racism is irrational. I think it's very much, there's a real economic and material purpose behind racializing Muslim bodies, you know. So there's that. There's also something that doesn't sit very well with me around using mental health issues to mark somebody as, you know, racist. In race scholarship, people use mental health issues as a way to denote how horrible racism is. And to me, that's problematic in terms of, like, we should not be stigmatizing mental health issues like this. And also, I don't think this is an individual mental health issue. I think this is actually serves a very large purpose, so that people are actually materially and, you know, psychologically benefiting from racism. And then the third thing is when you study the history of racism, that religion has always played a role in racism. So it's like, we don't need to create a new term for this, that anti-Muslim racism has been there long before 9/11. The term Islamophobia wasn't created after 9/11, but it gained traction after it. So I say all this with putting my ISPU hat back on. It is the term that's being used. It doesn't mean that, and people like Dr. Love, who's here at Dickinson, have done an excellent job of making the argument, you know, how we can look at Islamophobia as a form of racism. So I wouldn't say we throw the term out completely, but I think we can critique it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You mentioned that 9/11 has kind of exacerbated a lot of this anti-Muslim racism. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could describe more what was so particular or different about 9/11 compared to the terrorism that existed beforehand that really caused this change and made it such a momentous moment.
Yeah, so what 9/11 did was it didn't create the stereotypes around Muslims, but what it did was it institutionalized them. So because 9/11 was the largest terrorist attack on U.S. soil, immediately after 9/11, all these laws and policies were put into place. And as a result of these laws, like the USA Patriot Act, that was probably one of the biggest policies that just expanded the government's ability to surveil non-citizens, and I would say citizens alike, without stripping due process, a lot of the due process that was in place beforehand. And it was all in the name of protecting the country from another terrorist attack, so protecting national security. So what happens is, prior to 9/11, there's this, you know, association of Muslims, a stereotype about Muslims as being violent, barbaric, misogynistic, you know, anti-democratic, anti-Western, anti-American. And after 9/11, these laws and policies got put into place which, you know, was using that language about the terrorist, and without defining who the terrorist is. So you're right to note there have been attacks in the past. What makes this different? There's a wonderful book by Lisa Stampnitsky called Disciplining Terror. And what she does is she says, over time, in the United States, we used to look at those political acts of violence as, you know, insurgency or insurgent acts. And when it was seen as more of a political act of violence, there was more attention paid to the motivation behind those acts, not justifying them, but that we would want to understand, why did somebody commit this act of, you know, violence against, you know, whether they hijacked a plane or whatnot. And before 9/11, it slowly turned into the terrorist, calling them terrorists. And the terrorist was defined as somebody who was an irrational actor. There was no motivation behind it. So the difference is that, you know, the laws and policies just started, when they started to mark somebody as a potential terrorist, it just subjected them to the kind of policing and surveillance that we hadn't seen before. And a lot of this was done, you know, under the sort of stereotype that Muslims are this threat.
You've written two books, one of which was co-authored, but a handful of years apart. And I was wondering, as you got to collaborate with your co-authors and as you grew as a scholar, was there anything that changed for you? Any opinions that maybe you switched stances on, or you just felt like you learned a different side of? Or was there anything that really stayed the same and was solidified in the work that you did?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Collaborating is very different than writing something on your own, and I'm very grateful to my co-authors, Enosh Islam and Steve Garner. You know, in terms of they're very different books, because I feel like in the first book, you know, I'm telling other people's stories of what they've experienced. And so I think that's the part of the study that, like, when I would give talks on that book, that, you know, people were able to really grab onto the concepts because they were listening to people's stories, you know. Whereas in the second book, it's all laws and policies, and we didn't interview anyone. So it felt a little bit, for me, it felt odd to not talk to people about their experiences. Like, you know, anyway, so that was different. But I think what I realized is that, you know, I wrote that book 20 years after 9/11, and instead of seeing things get better, they've just expanded, you know? So a lot of what that book and the second book we show is that, you know, you would think, like, 20 years after 9/11, that's a long time. Like, perhaps we've become, you know, everyone thought after 9/11 it was a backlash, then that backlash would go away towards Muslims. But instead, what we see in the next book is how expansive these counterterrorism laws and policies are, that they're global and that they're being used for different means in different countries. And so sometimes I feel like I'm still where I'm in the same place.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like, you know,
it's
when
almost surprising that you're still in the same
it's place. Surprising that, yeah. I'm, you know, and it's, you know, there are times it can be somewhat depressing to think about, like, you know, when will we start to dismantle some of this stuff, you know, when will we start to really, and I see some efforts and there's some hope and all that, but I guess I feel like I still have a lot of work to do, and so do a lot of other people, but yeah.
You talked about how the interviews that you did for your first book were during your dissertation.
Yeah.
Did you know during that time that you were going to make a book out of it?
I mean, so to get tenure, you typically want your dissertation to get a book, to become a book. And I didn't have a job when I was doing it. I think so at the time of writing my dissertation, I feel like people were not open to the argument that I was making.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Because everybody was like, well, this is religious discrimination and not racism. And because in the canon, in the scholarship, racism was about your skin tone and
the biological,
your biological features,
yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really think I was going to get a book contract, because the feedback that I was getting from maybe perhaps people I was around was like, they didn't seem to really grab my argument, and my argument didn't seem to really hold. I feel like the argument was fairly strong, but I strengthened it after I, you know, got my PhD and wrote, you know, I did a lot of work to turn it into the book. But, you know, it just wasn't, people were just like, I just don't see this as racism. And so I didn't have that confidence. So I was really happy when I got that book contract, because I was like, and then to see how it's resonated is, that's really, you know, like I remember when I gave one of my first book talks, and people would just come up to me and say, I've had this experience. I'm Muslim. I've had this experience. I've gone through this exact same thing. And then I think when Trump was campaigning for his first for president for the first time, that's when people started saying, oh, Muslims experience race, like openly. Everybody was like, oh, Muslims are experiencing racism. So it took a long time to, I felt like it was a long road with this work, because it just wasn't something that people really thought Muslims were experiencing racism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your career path, you've done a number of different things.
Yeah.
I mean, you even worked at the Chicago Reader for a little while.
Loved it. Loved that time. So fun.
You spent over a decade at Simmons University as an associate professor and chair of the Department of Sociology.
Yeah.
And I guess I really would like to hear about your time working with students, and if that impacted your work, did it change the direction that you were taking?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I was very fortunate at Simmons to teach a class on, you know, I got to teach this really cool class called, it was co-taught, it was called Surveillance in America. And I had a colleague in political science who taught one section of the war on drugs. I taught a section on the war on terror, and then we co-taught surveillance. So we brought together the war on drugs on the war on terror. And so, of course, those conversations in the class, like, so all the students were very, I think they were drawn to this class because of the war on drugs, honestly, because they knew what the war on drugs was. They were like, absolutely, I want to take a class on, you know, mass incarceration. And, you know, this was at a time when we were seeing more attention being paid to policing and Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives. And so, and then they would sit quietly in the war on terror section because they were like, what's this, you know? And they were making really fascinating connections in you know, in the class that we co-taught. And those conversations that we had with those students was really amazing. And so I think, like, of course, and then my colleague, he and I decided we were going to do a project together where we were going to interview African-American and Black Muslims about their experiences both in the war on drugs and the war on terror. So, you know, that came from a class, you know, and the students at Simmons were just, you know, they're absolutely wonderful. And I loved teaching and working with them. So, yeah.
Your past work that you did at Simmons, do you think it's really impacted, like, anything you do now at the ISBU?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because I used to run the internship with our seniors at Simmons. And, you know, seniors will come in and they'll be like, I still don't know what I want to do. And you're like, I would have to be like, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Because I would pull out my CV and say, I know everything looks, some of these things look disconnected, but they're all connected. And they've all led me to what, you know, where I am. So for me, another academic sent me an email saying, they're looking for a director of research. They're hiring. I think you should apply. And I was like, apply? Why would I apply? I'm going to be a professor until I retire, you know? But it's an unusual place. It's a research organization and think tank that studies exclusively American Muslims. There's no other organization like this in the United States. And I was increasingly feeling like I wanted, you know, it's great to teach students. And I got a lot out of that. But I was increasingly feeling like I wanted my work to influence policy. And so this is what we do at ISPU. So we take research and we meet with policymakers. We meet with politicians. We meet with people who are crafting legislation. We meet with the community, the Muslim community, to help them, you know. So having a PhD, having experience with research, having taught a social research methods class, knowing qualitative and quantitative, that all led me to be qualified for this.
The ISPU just released its American Muslim poll for 2025.
Yeah.
I was hoping to talk about that.
Yes, I'm love sure, to.
Like you mentioned earlier, it has on it a section on the Islamophobia Index.
Yes.
And I was really hoping that you could go into what is included in that.
Yeah.
What are the implications maybe of a higher Islamophobia index for society?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to talk about this tonight too, but like the Islamophobia index, they've been doing this at ISPU. So this is the 7th American Muslim poll. And there are really no other surveys except for Pew on American Muslims. And Pew, the last one they did was like, I think in 2017. So what we do at ISPU is we survey Muslims, but we also survey a general population. So we oversample Muslims because they're 1-2% of the U.S. population. They don't exist naturally in the national representative sample. And we oversample a Jewish population. And then we survey the general population so we can compare responses. What are Muslim experiences like compared to Catholic, white evangelical, Protestant, Jewish people in the United States? So we asked them a series of questions about Muslims. And the questions are Muslims misogynistic? There are five questions. It's a measure. It's called the Islamophobia Index. So it's a measure. So are Muslims, hostile to the United States? Are Muslims, do they trend towards violence? Are Muslims more likely, are Muslims responsible for an act of violence committed by another Muslim, even, you know? And the higher your score is on this, the more likely you are to have Islamophobic, you know, sort of sentiments or anti-Muslim sentiments. And so what we're able to do with this index is show who ranks high based on, we can do it based on a lot of, we do it based on religion. So Catholics, white evangelicals, Protestants, Jewish, Muslims, and we're able to look at it over time. So our group's becoming more or less Islamophobic. So it tells us a lot. It tells us, like, one, where does some work need to be done, you know, in terms of dismantling myths around Muslims. It also tells us a little bit, and I'll show this on the slide later today, but, like, people who trend to rank higher on that also tend to believe more or have more anti-democratic sentiments or, you know, feelings. Like, they tend to adopt more anti-democratic sentiments. So it's pretty interesting.
I found that really interesting because honestly that hadn't been something that I really had associated with each other before. But it's great. It's really interesting to see there's research behind it and like real data.
It's a really important and I think like this is something that we can really, like you said, it's actually just this data that's very useful, and to see it in charts and things like that, people then, you know, they feel like they can trust that for some reason.
The end of the poll there's a section recommending ways through which we can address the challenges that are facing American Muslims today. Specifically, it cites supporting Muslim civic engagement.
Yeah.
What does this look like and how is it effective?
Yeah. So 2020 was when we saw the largest number of Muslims turn out to vote. And so there are Muslim organizations. This is the thing that, like, I think most, you know, people might not realize is that one of the things that 9/11 created was all these counterterrorism laws and policies and increase in discrimination against Muslims, things like that. But it also, there's a counter to that. There's always a counter. Racialization is never met without resistance, you know? And so part of that is there are Muslim organizations that are organizing the Get Out the Vote campaign. There are more Muslims running for office. There are more Muslims that are calling their representatives, demanding, you know, asking that their needs be met, you know, federal, local, state. There are Muslims who are donating to campaigns. There are Muslims. So civic engagement is a lot of different things. It's not just voting. It's not just political participation, but it's engaging with the process. And so we've seen an increase, a major increase in that. Even, and we talk about this in one of our other, we had an election survey in swing states before the election to see how Muslims were going to vote. And this was coming off the uncommitted movement where we saw so many people withhold their votes for when Biden was running for president, and they were demanding a ceasefire in Palestine. So, you know, I think this really shows Muslims are organizing, they're running for office at record levels. We have the first Muslim mayor of New York City, which is wild.
Big news these days, yeah.
It is huge. And so, and he did it unabashedly being Muslim. He wasn't like, I'm going to hide that I'm Muslim. I'm not going to go to the mosque. But he went and talked to so many New Yorkers who are the majority are not Muslim and said, I care about your community. I care about the LGBTQ community. I care about, you know, the issues that African-Americans are facing. I care about Jewish New Yorkers, you know. So I think civic engagement is clearly important for Muslims. And our recommendation is, like, we need to do more work to get more Muslims active in the political process and engaged in governance in the United States.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd really love to talk about some of the recent work of yours that I hear about. Maybe a new book coming up in the works.
Oh, man. I don't know. I did a study before I left. I have a couple things, ideas I have. But one thing is I interviewed actually around 40... I want to say I've interviewed close to 40, maybe a little over 40. I have to go back and look because I have so many projects that I have to oversee. But this was before I came to ISPU, and I had interviewed South Asian, Arab, and African American and Black second generation. So, you know, their parents are immigrants and they're Black in the United States. Muslims, about their experiences with policing and surveillance. So I've written a journal article on it, and I'm wanting to do a book on it. I just have to find the time between my new job. But I would like to put out write another book on, you know, really digging deep into the racial and ethnic differences of experiences of African-American Muslims with South Asian and Arab Muslims. Because I think when we talk about Muslim, we are mostly thinking of South Asian and Arab Muslims, and we're ignoring the experiences of African-American Muslims. So that's something I learned through my first book when I would go and give this talk, and there would be, you know, people would be like, what about African-American Muslims? I'm like, well, I didn't interview them, so they're not in this book. But it is a missing piece. There are scholars who are doing some of this work, but that's something that I hope to write a book about. And then I kind of want to write, as I'm getting older, I'm like, I sort of want to write for fun, but I don't know how to do that yet. So I'm thinking about that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciated that about your most recent book in the part. It's based on the United States, UK, India, and China.
Yeah.
And in the history sections where you talk about how Muslims have been installed and had long, long histories in each of these countries. In the United States one specifically, you talk about how Muslims came over through like the Atlantic slave trade,
yeah,
and how a lot of them were African American Muslims,
yeah,
and how that population is often overlooked and such.
Yeah, and it's overlooked in terms of thinking that Islam is new to the United States. And mm-hmm. at ISPU, actually, we have a whole study on indigenous Muslims, which I didn't even know there were indigenous Muslims. I know. And I went to talk about it when I first started at ISPU at Indiana University. And like, we were talking after the, you know, we had one of the participants who is an indigenous Muslim talk about her experiences. And we were all talking about it. And we don't know, but there could have been, you know, there. So the history of Islam in China, obviously India, the UK and the United States is much longer than this notion that these are new immigrants coming to invade the United States, that this is part and parcel of the history of, you know, the United States through that system of slavery. Yeah.
We're getting close to the end here, but for any listeners who would like to learn more about your work and stay connected with you and the ISPU,
yeah,
how would you recommend they do that?
Yes, they can go to ispu.org and they can find my page there and they can reach out to me, Saher Sahlod, S-A-H-E-R-S-E-L-O-D. I'm the director of research. And just I would welcome exploring our reports at ISPU. And then I'm also happy to talk about the research that I've done on my own, too. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you. This concludes our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you for sharing your time and perspective today.
Thank you so much for having me.